Session number 14806.
Mr. Eddie Murray, side 22.
Yes, I used to get parcels.
Yes.
Food parcels. My mother used to send me in North Africa, and I'm quite sure that 99% of them arrived. Mm. But well, usually with something missing, you know.
Being
opened en route.
What out of interest were you, the favorite? What were your favorite foods, or what was sent?
Oh, well, I mean, it was all a question of being practical in sending things. I mean, they wouldn't send me a carton of milk for cream, for instance. Right. But she did. She was a wonderful baker and cook.
Right.
And she used to bake cakes for me,
okay,
and send me
cakes
a cake.
And so forth.
And Genoa cake or something.
Right. Presumably from the fall of France, until you got to Calcutta, you've got no real idea of what was going on in England. You've got a lot of catching up to do. I knew all these Alamein and the Blitz and Dunkirk, mm-hmm, and so forth.
Knew nothing. Hardly knew anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, but yes. Well, in India, of course, they had newspapers.
Yes, so you had a lot of catching up.
A lot of catching up to do. Yes.
What did you expect regarding Blitz and so forth?
I knew for a fact and expected London to be in a bit of a state with all the bombings that had taken place. Mm. And although I must say that as soon as I got out into the city of London and had a look round, it was deplorable. I was amazed at the destruction that the bombs had caused and the fires.
Mm. And the flying bombs?
All of it.
Yes.
And I mean, my brother put me in the picture.
Sorry, did you say flyers or fires?
Fires.
I beg your pardon. All right. Okay.
Sorry. And my brother, of course, put me in the picture because he'd been intimately concerned in quite a lot of them in the West London. And, you know, the fire brigades in those days, the London Fire Brigade, you belonged to the Acton station. But that didn't mean to say that you were going to be confined to the Acton area.
Yes.
There were times when the conflagration was such that they had to call in numerous fire brigades, and they all attended. So my brother was able to put me into the picture as far as all that destruction.
What job was arranged for you, if anything? You know, and what were you think you were going to go into when you came back to England?
Oh, I
Did
knew.
Did they set you up for anything, or
no.
You were on your bike?
I think, you know, it was all in the hands of the gods.
Ah, right. Okay.
Really, there wasn't anything arranged for me at all.
So you had stopped being, I mean, you're off the pay books of the...
I'm off the payroll, yes, from the moment I land in England.
Right.
In England, yes.
Yeah.
As soon as I land in England.
Okay.
I went to the War Office, I believe. I had to go to the War Office or something.
No,
like
just to say, well, just to say
I was back,
up,
yes,
or something,
tidy, yeah.
Yes. And... what did they say? I mean, did you...
Or maybe it was the... I had to go to the police station for ration books, didn't I? Or the local employment bureau for ration books.
Right.
And also to sign on as an unemployed.
Right.
If I remember rightly. I can't remember ever having received a halfpenny of dole or anything like that. Or even having been out of work more than 5 or 6 days.
Mm.
Ever.
Okay, including this time.
Including this time. Mm.
So you arrived back in England, and what was the morale like there? I mean, you know, it must have been compared to being a very senior.
Everybody
very senior.
Was tired. I remember everybody was tired, appeared to be tired, and
why? Working.
Well, it had been such a momentous period, you know, and you don't get over. 4 years war of bombing and destruction taking place in your backyard sort of business without being tired. And then, of course, they had air raid shelters to go to. And this is, you know, I mean, not very long after the end of the war in Europe. And so people were still tired, and there was this rationing and queuing to take place. And as far as a job being arranged for me, there I was perhaps incorrect, because my brother had already started these talks with a friend of his who was the deputy manager at Brown's Hotel
Yes. You know? So, I mean, what was the? I mean, you'll come from this life of luxury, really. I mean, you'd had a very rough time for a long time, but your immediate peers in have been a quite a senior position in the lap of luxury and on a first-class ticket.
Yes.
So what was the morale and state of everybody in England then, and you got back, would you say, compared to, it must have seemed quite drab.
Everything seemed drab, yes, is the correct word. And then, as I said, I mean, there's all this rationing and queuing up and the obtaining of ration books and people looking so desolate in the streets, and I suppose the buses and the tubes were running, but not very often. And there was an air of... everybody was dismal. And there was no enthusiasm being shown by anybody at the time, as far as I can remember. I'm sure there were still the after effects of the destruction that had been caused on London and Britain, other cities as well. But also, I suppose that perhaps one or maybe two or three people out of every ten that you met or passed in the street had suffered a loss. Either abroad in the fighting services or through the fires and the bombing and all that sort of thing. And so naturally it was normal, I found, that everybody should be depressed.
And was it actually run down, that, I mean, everything needed to go to paint?
Everything was run down, yes, indeed. Lots of paint was required, I'm quite sure. But there was, even in the Acton area and other areas that I visited, you see, you just couldn't walk, you know, 200 or 300 yards without coming upon a house that was destroyed or a shop that was windowless and things like this.
But that, it had all been tidied up, though, largely, had it?
No. They were beginning to tidy it up, but it was such a huge business, and they had to get money to do all the tidying up, and people just didn't have money.
But they got piles of bricks. I mean, it had been swept off the street, or it was in a state of
the streets were reasonably clear. But no, it was months and months afterwards before one could see any.
So it was more or less the bomb sites were
still there.
Yes, but I mean, they're more or less they're quite fresh, and they're more or less as they'd happened.
As they'd happened, right. Yes, indeed. Mm. But another remarkable thing that I noticed was that a flower I'd never seen in my life before was beginning to grow on all these destroyed places.
Yes.
I don't know, was it called the fire?
I don't know.
It was a red flower. And quite a weed, I'm sure, yes, a weed. Mm. And, you know, one found this flower flourishing wherever there had been destruction.
And where, and was there any nightlife or anything like that? Or
I was never the one for nightlife. So, you know, and there was my mother, and she'd been suffering throughout the war. She'd been working in some sort of factory. And my father had been working in a factory in Acton. For the moment, I can't remember what it was. So they'd been working throughout the war for the war effort. My father suffered from asthma. Or we'll call it asthma, but it was certainly something that he'd caught in the mines.
Throughout the mines. Yes.
And he suffered greatly, and he used to have one of these, you know, sort of inhaler with a bulb that he put in his nostrils or in his mouth, the back of his mouth, and then pressed on this bulb and used to get this from the liquid from the doctor. So I suppose it was the forerunner of my own Ventolin inhaler.
Yes. Yeah, but that was the pump that they use for the doctor uses.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes, a sort of
to check your blood pressure pump.
That's right. Yes, something like that.
You were saying you weren't one for the nightlife.
No, I was never one for the nightlife.
Pubs and so forth.
And remember, I'm not. I don't have a job. I'm out of a job. I've got quite a bit of money. Not a lot of money in my pocket, and didn't have a bank account. That's one thing certain. everything, every penny in Calcutta that came in also went out on good living out there.
Right.
You see.
So, I mean, were pubs?
Pubs were the dullest possible things you could see.
Really?
And I mean, my father had used a pub, and then my mother told me which pub he'd used, and so naturally, very occasionally, I would take her out for a drink to this pub, and I visited other pubs. But they were the most depressing places that one could ever wish to find. They just hadn't been decorated or anything like that during the war, and there was a restriction on the amount of scotch, for instance, that you could drink, and even on the beer. And the beer was, you know, pretty poor, apparently, but I was never a beer drinker. Mm. I've always been a Scotch man myself.
Yes. Just from what you're saying, I mean, it was not so much to have a good time, but to sort of get out of the cold or something. Waiting room.
Of course, it was the winter. Mm. And then my brother came. Maybe he phoned me up. But he communicated with me and told me that, you know, to meet him at a certain place near Green Park. Mm. It might have been in Brown's, as a matter of fact, in the club there. To meet up with this Mr. Rollman, who was the deputy manager. And so, of course, we made an appointment, and I went there, kept the appointment, and that was the beginning of my working days in London.
Right. And so about 5 days after you came
landed,
you managed to get a job in Brown's?
Yes. No, not in Brown's. Oh, no. He was the deputy manager of Brown's, but he was going to start up his own travel bureau, travel office.
Travel agency.
Right. And he'd done most of the grand work and was organized. He was going to have an office in the basement of Marshall and Snellgrove's in Oxford Street.
And what's that now? It's Debenhams or something, is it?
Debenhams is further up. I don't know where I don't think Marshall and Snellgrove. But it's probably still a big store. Mm. But it was a big store then, one of the very, very important stores in London. And we had this office in the basement, which was quite a size. And it was there that our next meeting took place. And, of course, Ullman was delighted to have me, not only because he was doing a favour to a friend of his, Tom. How they met, I don't know. But Ullman himself had a wonderful war record. He'd been in submarines as a commander or deputy commander, lieutenant commander, and he'd on a cargo boat. That's right. He'd been sunk 3 times by German submarines.
Really? Mm. But was he English or had he got a?
No, he had an Eastern European background. But I'm sure that he was naturalised British.
So we're starting again after a pause. You got a job with Mr. Ullman, who had been shot in the Merchant Navy and all the rest of it in the war.
Yes, I had a wonderful war record.
Yes,
a very pleasant character.
Yeah,
and he never, ever during the years. Well, during the years that he was a friend. I never was able to find exactly from which country he came.
Okay, right.
It was a mystery.
What was Brown's Hotel that got enough?
It was a club, really.
Was it?
Yes, and it had, I mean, it's like Brown's and White, you know.
But it is a hotel now.
It had an hotel for members. It had accommodation for members.
Ah.
It was a club.
And that's just,
opposite Green Park Station?
Yes, opposite the Ritz.
Remember the name of the street there? Yes, just before you get to the Ritz on the left-hand side in Piccadilly.
Okay, and so what did your duties involve with that?
Well, of course, immediately he'd packed up his association with the hotel, or with the club, and he'd travelled he travelled during the first 2 weeks or so. He was travelling all over Europe, which he'd done even while he was club business. He travelled all over Europe investigating the possibilities of, he was certain he was going to do it, but the possibilities of various hotels, mm-hmm. and had concluded contracts with them. You see, that he was going to supply so many tourists throughout the season, the 1946 season, and you know, he was quite firm about it. He was a man who knew his oats as far as the hotel business was concerned, and accommodation required for tourists. He was a very, very wily person, but a very, very correct man, and a gentleman in every respect, but a man with, he knew where he was going. Mm-hmm. His English was tainted, shall we say, with European languages, but he spoke, you know, half a dozen languages fluently. And he was a lovely character, and he was very, very friendly with Tom, my brother. And I don't know in what capacity, because by that time my brother was at West End Central. He'd moved from Stoke Newington to West End Central CID. And so I'm sure that they came he came into contact with Ullman during that period, whose first name, Bella, for instance, B-L-A. And now then, so he'd investigated the possibilities of all the hotels in Europe, and he knew, and he'd established relations with Hoyes, who was a coach owner in Belgium. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, when we got moving early in 46, I suppose it was about March or April, so it was very, very shortly after I was back in England, you see, so there was no period when, except for a week, perhaps, that I was unemployed, hence my mentioning the fact that I've never received any dole. And so, eventually, he told me that I would be, he gave me a list, traveller's list, and in those days, in order to get a tour of 24, a group of 24 people, for instance, through customs and immigration people, the list would be established, and I would go to the different embassies to get their stamp onto this list. I didn't take passports along. We just had all their details of names and addresses and passport numbers on this list that I took around to the Belgian embassy, the French embassy, the German embassy, and the Swiss embassy, you see, to have them authenticated.
And that was necessary at that time, was it?
It was necessary in that time to prevent any
holdups.
No, I think it was just because of the holdups to prevent being held up at the frontier. Mm. It used to start, the tours used to start at Victoria.
Right.
At the, it went at 10 o'clock in the morning, the Golden Arrow.
All right. Yes.
The Golden Arrow. So right. We used to catch the Golden Arrow down to Dover. And there we'd disembark, and I would be by that time in possession of all the passports, everybody's passport. And I would precede them, see that everybody got out and see that all their luggage, count the number of pieces of luggage that was there. And I'd made myself, I'd introduced myself to every passenger, which was very important. And some of them would have queries and this sort of thing. And then off at Dover, and then we'd embark on the ferry to Ostend. And on board there was usually the immigration officer, the Belgian immigration officer, or even the British immigration officer. Sometimes they were on board, sometimes they weren't. But in any case, I was armed with this list of my tourists, together with all their passports, whether they were, whatever nationality they were. We had Americans and people like that who used to travel with us. and get them through, and then I would see them through the customs, and if ever there were any, if there were queries, you know, I would be called upon, and so I eventually got to know most of the immigration officers and the customs officers at Dover, and they knew that I wouldn't get up into any stupid business, do you see. They begin to rely on couriers, do you see, to sort out any troubles.
Were there any many other tours like this going on at the time?
Yes, other people were doing the same tours, but not many. This was really an innovation.
Right.
And Ullman had really gone into it, and he knew good hotels. And he, for the first season, you know, they were very, very reasonably priced, these tours. And he'd done them himself, do you see? He'd gone, he'd done the tours himself with his wife, and so he knew what he was talking about.
And, how, I mean, which sort of countries and sites did they visit?
And so we went across to Belgium, and there we got off the ferry boat, and there at the, which is quite changed now in Ostend, but the station, the railway station is there, you know, at the quayside, and there's also parking for coaches, and so we just got off the boat and into Hoyer's coach with a driver, and Hoyer's was always there, Leon Hoyer's, and there were, you know, and so there was a driver, and I would be sitting up the front with the driver, and off we'd go via the Route Royale, and I, of course, had read up on all this Belgian business, and so I was a very, very competent courier. This was, you know,
well,
travel.
What is the Route Royale? I've never heard of that.
It's one of the important places in roads in Brussels.
Route Royale, yes.
Route
okay.
Royale. And
okay.
So you go from Ostend to Brussels, and we'd give them a tour of Brussels, do you see? And then on our way via Bastogne.
Oh, Bastogne.
Bastogne,
yes.
Which was very famous during the war. Yeah. That was the pocket of Bastogne, you know, where the Americans faced formidable.
I was there about 2 months ago. Anyway.
Really? And so I remember that we always used to pass this tank on the right. Oh, there was another place we used to visit, was La Bière, where the monks made beer. A very, very famous beer. No, Orvat.
Okay.
La Bière d'Orvat. Or Orval, maybe.
Ah,
Orval.
Yes.
Bière d'Orval. And we used to, you know, drop off there for a drink. And people would buy the beer. Then we'd go on to Bastogne.
Yes.
On the left-hand side was the was a restaurant. Oh, Le Bras. Because that was the name of the family that had owned this place for a long, long time. And one of the daughters has a terribly interesting story later on to tell about the about one of the daughters. They were very, very Catholic. But they always used to look after us, you see, very, very well indeed. And on occasions, we had wild boar. But this young lady had been given a medal for the way she'd conducted herself when the Americans were there, you know, during the war. And so she was a very, very nice person. And then from Bastogne, we used to go on to Luxembourg, through Luxembourg, and then on to Colmar, via, you know, quite a number of towns and cities and villages that I could tell you, but it was a good road on the way to Switzerland.
What was the atmosphere in, I mean, Colmar was Alsace.
Alsace, yes.
I mean, that had been part of the Reich for three or four years, possibly.
Well, they'd always had wars. Yeah, I think the last one was 1871. And so we used to go, and we used to have a, we always used to have a meal at Colmar. And they were very, very receptive, and I enjoyed that very, very much indeed. And I, you know, and I used to take photographs. Then we went to Switzerland, and there, the Swiss frontier people were quite tough in those days. And you know, normally they wouldn't take just a list. They wanted to see every passport and examine the luggage. On occasions, the French people would have the boot opened, you know. And I've got pictures of where, you know, the customs are examining the luggage and all
did
that.
You have
sort of
to, Do you have to sell them cigarettes or anything?
No, that was against my principles.
Well, it's against everybody's. Well, you know, it's against my principles.
No, no. But it was one of those things. I knew we had nothing wrong with the people, you see, and I trusted them. And no, on occasions, perhaps a packet of cigarettes or something like that, English cigarettes, which, you know, they didn't have on the continent.
What did the Belgians, what did the Belgians make of the Brits, you know, at that time as tourists?
I mean, we were bringing money into the country. Mm. And that was the one of the best things about Ullman's tactics, you see. We were using Belgian coaches,
of course.
And so everybody was hands down, you see, let's help them as much as we can.
We
used to stop off at places like Nancy would be on the way, that's in France, on the way back. Liège, but that's not another place near Leopold's Leap or something like that. Roland's Leap. It's just a very narrow passageway. On that side you've got the river, and on this side the mountainside, and it curves over in a sort of an archway.
Where is this?
And this is in through Liège. On the way to Luxembourg, and on the way to Arlon. It was before that. I can't remember.
All right. Yeah.
You know, I would have to look it up.
Yes.
But that was an interesting place, so I learned. You know, I used to read it all up, and Ullman had the books and all the rest of it, and I also had books at home, and bought. You know, on my first trip, I'd bring brochures back, and really, I became. An extremely good courier, though I say it myself.
Okay. Was Bastogne, was that 46 very bad? I mean, I've been there several times. Was it very badly beaten up at that time, the town itself?
You know, I was occupied. No, not. We didn't go into the town, really. We stayed at the restaurant, and then off we went. Because we...
Well, was there a lot of damage or injury in the town, do you remember? Okay.
There was, of course, there wasn't. Now I've got a picture of it in my mind now, and I can see that there was a lot of destruction. But there were also lots of building works taking place, and new buildings going up with red roofs, red tiled roofs, and all the rest of it. I can see it there. But the food was always extremely good, and yet they were also rationed. But occasionally we had wild boar, but you know. No, they had extremely good food.
And did you go, where else did you go?
So we went through Luxembourg on one occasion. When we went through Luxembourg, I met up with, you know, I saw him from the window, and he looked, and he was in business then. One of my ex-colleagues from City Blabès, he'd been in the region.
Yes.
And he was there. I got his address, I wrote, but I've never had an answer or anything like that. And on one occasion also, this was really something, because I've just been talking about it in the book, that, when was it? Oh dear. Now it was in 46 that we started. So it was in 46. And so there we go into, and then suddenly halted by the police in Luxembourg, you know, and diversion signs and all the rest of it. And I asked, what, you know? So he said, well, not immediately here, but a mile further on through the city, you see, before you get to the end, you'll have to either stop the coach or take a long diversion to the left. And I said, well, what is it all about? So they said, well, an important personage has come to the frontier, you see, and he's English, and you won't be able to go through. They'll not let you through. So I said, oh, well, fine. And so I pulled up, you know, just past this policeman and pulled up. And... I asked the ladies for their lipstick. Oh, he told me it was Churchill. I'd guessed it was Churchill, something like this. And so, with lipstick, I made a great big V on the front of the coach.
All right.
And we had a union, somebody had a Union Jack, and we put the Union Jack on the front of the bonnet, and then off we went. And there am I, you see, every policeman that I met, you see. We are going to meet Churchill at the frontier, do you see, important. Official, you know, official, we're going to meet Churchill at the frontier, And right until the last 200 yards, when we were 200 yards from the frontier, and a turn, a lane to the left, And the last policeman said, no, there's no room for you there. He said, you have to get out and walk. And so we parked the coach there, and we walked to the frontier, and we stood on the right-hand side, and Churchill came, and he got out of his car, and he walked over the frontier, raising his black hat, and there we were, and we sang, for he's a jolly good fellow, to Churchill, and he raised his hat again to us, and we gave us the V sign, and we sang hip hip hooray. Now that was 46. All I knew about Churchill is that he'd been Prime Minister during the war. You know, he didn't come into our life out in the Far East, not really, except, you know, De Gaulle and Churchill occasionally. And so there, he'd been to Paris to receive the Croix de Guerre, which medal I have myself. And there, that was the first time I'd seen Churchill, you see. And so we got back into the coach, he went on to a reception somewhere, and we got into the coach then, off we went again, and we kept the V sign and the Union Jack until we got as far as Montreux in Switzerland. And that was where, you know, this bloke standing on the curb, while just we were about to turn left to go to our hotel, there he is standing on the curb, and I looked out the window, and I waved to him.